So you're actually the first person to ride the Matterhorn.
I do not like roller coasters, and I've never ridden one. And then Walt calls me over and says, well, we've decided on the shape of the mountain and all these little holes in it and things and waterfalls. And he says, we're going to put a roller coaster in here. Oh, by the way, put two tracks in there. And then he walks away. I taught myself trig in 15 minutes.
Come on.
So I designed this whole thing, and then they build it and install it. Man, my boss, he says, Robert, you design it, you ride it. Well, we survived it.
Yo, welcome to another episode of In a Minute with Evan Lovett, coming to you live from the I Am Studios in the heart of LA. And if your heart has been full in Los Angeles, it is possibly due to this very special guest that I have in studio. We are talking about Bob Gurr, one of the original Imagineers. And this is not just a man who had a hand in Disney or Disneyland, but the quote was, if it's at Disneyland and it moves, Bob probably had a hand in its design. We are talking some of the most legendary and favorite rides of all time, from the Haunted Mansion, the Submarine Voyage, which when I was a kid was one of my favorite, underrated, underappreciated in my opinion, Autopia, Matterhorn, the Monorail, the Little Red Fire Engine on Main Street. The list goes on and on. Bob is probably the reason, I don't say the reason, but one of the main reasons that theme parks today operate the way that they do, and why the world just enjoys Disneyland and all of its parks. I can't even do justice to the impact that he's had, not just in Disneyland, but in Los Angeles as a Los Angeles native. And we are super excited to have him on the show. Bob, thank you so much for being here.
Well, good morning, Evan. It's my enjoyment to come talk to you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you. And I do want to say, I have to say something. We are having a giveaway today. It's the first time we've ever done this. We received a package from Disney, a big old box, by the way. Disneyland handcrafted. It is full of some great items to celebrate 70 years of Disneyland. And stay tuned for the end of the show to see what those items are and how you can be entered into this giveaway. This is the perfect guest for this. So I'm excited about the giveaway, and I hope you are too. One last thing of business before we really get into it. Today's show is sponsored by Copico. Great sponsor, man. These are coffee-flavored candies that actually have 40 milligrams of caffeine in each. So two of these is equivalent to a cup of coffee. And let me tell you something. I'm driving around long days, busy days. You know, you get that afternoon swoon. Sometimes you don't have time to stop for coffee. Pop a Copico, and they really work. They get the energy going. So thank you, Copico, for being a proud and great sponsor. And I don't need an energy burst to jump into this interview. I want to start, Mr. Gurr, I have to say.
I am Bob.
All right.
Even now, I guess you're a Mr. one time only, but you got two of them there.
All right. I got my one warning, my mulligan. Bob, I want to start. Let's go. I usually go somewhat chronologically, but I want to go backwards on this one. Talk to me about your legacy, because Disney is one of the biggest, most beloved brands in the world. Disneyland is more than a theme park. It's like, it's this concept of, you know, you're going to Disneyland, you know, the Super Bowl winners used to go to Disneyland, all this kind of. So your legacy is fantastic and renowned worldwide. What does that make you feel? What do you think of that?
Well, when I first saw that there was going to be a Disneyland, there was a beautiful drawing of it in the LA Times.
Okay.
And at the same time, I knew that something was up at the Disney studio, because I knew somebody, you know, worked at the studio. And there was a little car chassis, no body on it, running around. And then one day I got a cold call saying, Bob, go to the Disney studio in 20 minutes, meet a Mr. Irvine, click. On the drive to the studio.
Hold on. Why did you, if it was a cold call, it just, that's a little suspicious.
It was a cold call, yes. Anyway, I thought that park and that little itty-bitty car, which is amusement car, they might have something related. It was a guess.
Okay.
So, yes, I go to the Disney studio, go in the Buena Vista gate, and there is a Mr. Irvine at the time clock waiting for me.
Okay.
Walks me into the studio, and within a few hours of looking around and discussion, I find out Mr. Irvine is in charge of all the design of an amusement park to be called Disneyland.
Wow.
So, in other words, that is as cold call as you're ever going to get.
Yep, yep.
Right. So, I wound up seeing what they needed and said, okay, I'll come back the end of the week and I'll bring a few sketches about what you're probably looking for.
Right.
So, I did that. And then, of course, the second week, I bring more sketches. Saturday morning, early, the little chassis out there. There's some gentlemen start collecting around the car, and you know they put their foot on the wheel and put their elbow on the knee, and they cogitate. We had a spare wheel available, and this older guy walks up, kind of unshaven looking, and we all talk about it. And then the guy walks away, and then everybody says, "See you, Walt." Was that Walt Disney? I never met him. So by week three,
yeah,
we're back out there again. And Walt starts asking me about the books I've written about automobile design. And I thought, oh, there's more going on here than I thought. And of course, I learned over the next couple of months the how and the why I'm there. But we went to work immediately.
Right.
So in other words, it was like Walt worked with people.
Yeah.
Never spoke down to people. So yes, his name was on the building, but he's out working with people all
yeah
the time.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of environment that came from a cold call.
Okay. Where did the cold call come from, though? Give me the origin of that. How did they, your background, you were, you know, you grew up in, you went to North Hollywood High School. I always got to represent Valley. That was my dad's alma mater as well. But a Los Angeles native, Valley native, right? And some of your early memories are of the Glendale Central Air Terminal, which, by the way, was the main airport in Los Angeles. We've reported on that here, which is kind of insane to think about, as now it's a Disney campus, correct? Or,
yes,
or what technically?
Yes.
So, but it's funny because it's in the middle of Glendale and you wouldn't notice, but you grew up there and maybe just being around the airplanes and you were always interested in kind of engineering cars, planes, things like that. Take us through how that led to you receiving that cold call.
All right, 5 years old, two big passions popped up are permanent, cars and airplanes, and everything is derived from those two interests.
Okay.
All right, back to why the cars. It turns out that long before I went to the Disney studio, you know, as an employee,
yeah,
I knew Ward Kimball, who was one of Walt's nine old men, and he had a railroad in his backyard. He liked to collect cars, and he had a 1916 American LaFrance fire engine, and he called me one day to drive it in a parade. Okay, see how that link I
yep
got connected quick?
Yep.
And the reason for that was some of the books that I wrote, which I told you about earlier, was post-publications who lived very near Ward Kimball's house. Anyway, there was another guy at the studio, Ben Sharpstein, a producer, and these guys were all in a car club that I was in too, the Horseless Carriage Club. It was for antique automobiles.
Okay.
Now, the way Walt worked, he didn't put an ad in the paper like a normal person would do. He would ask around anybody who knew. He said, "Say, do you know somebody who can do this? Do you know somebody who can do that?" And apparently he asked the question, "Say, do you know anybody who can come in here and put a little body on this little chassis?" And two guys spoke up. And they said, "Call Bob." and they had my phone number. So the phone number obviously was passed down to a Mr. Irvine probably.
Yeah.
Because that's the guy I was told to meet.
Okay. And you didn't know Mr. Irvine?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
I knew nothing about the Disney company except that when the studio was being built in the 30s,
yeah,
we lived in North Hollywood, and my father would drive us to his store in Glendale, and this big building was going up. Well, what is that going to be? He says, "No, that's going to be the home of Mickey Mouse." Well, you see, I like the duck better than the mouse, you see, so... Yes.
Interesting.
So that's all I knew about Disney. I didn't know what he looked like.
Sometimes it's even better that way, you know, because you don't have the expectations or the nervousness or anything.
No, see, it's like resonate. I don't know you, so you and I can just talk.
Right. That's a good way. That's yeah a good way to look at it. a little bit about your childhood, though, before. And then we'll get into the bigger story. When did you start tinkering? When did you sort of get into the engineering and the putting things together, taking things apart, figuring out all that kind of
stuff? Okay, back to the five years old.
Yeah.
All right. It was quite obvious that I was very interested in a lot of things. Anything you could put your hands on.
Yeah.
And so one Christmas, my father would buy me a little toys.
Okay.
I had to know the inside of the toy. I had to know how it's built and why it's built that way. But I take it apart, but I was never good about putting it back together, can you? So that was a disappointment, I think. Also, anyway, one Christmas, very early, he bought me a Tinker Toy set.
Yeah.
You know, it's like an oatmeal canister full
classic.
Of sticks and hubs. Yeah.
Yeah.
I could start making stuff I like. And then the following Christmas was a nice big metal box, a Rector set. It had nuts and bolts and screws and electrical pieces and wheels and all kinds of doodads. And I was off to the races by taking something that had not been put together, and I could put it together my way.
Yeah.
And take it apart and rebuild it every couple of days and anything that I liked. And I, in retrospect, I would look back and I wrote, why did I always make something that didn't exist when most kids make something that already exists?
Yeah.
I never understood that why, but then that linked up with the idea of what did I wind up doing at Disney? So you see, there's a natural curiosity that a lot of people have. Now, Walt had curiosity, extremely solid part of life. Yeah. He collected people like-minded. People that were, they might be educated or not, but they're self-taught.
Yeah.
And their self-taught is from the curiosity thing. So I got mixed in with this tribe of people being expanded at a rapid rate every month, starting in October of 1954.
Wow. And then, okay, so did you know right away that this was a special group of people?
Not in the first couple of days, but every
right
because right. I had another fill-in job I was doing for an industrial design company, and then one day it looked like, say, this amusement park thing might be a go, and I just happened to mention maybe I ought to come over here.
Yeah.
And then quick as they could do it, they signed me up just like that.
That's
so it. That meant I was there every day, not just on a weekend.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because in the meantime, I was bringing in my drawings on Saturday morning. I had a JCPenney invoice pad, and I had made a rubber stamp, R.H. Gurr Industrial Design, and they would pay me on the spot.
Wow.
Just like that. And then suddenly I'm an employee.
Whole different.
Then I started meeting all these people. And the way it was laid out at the Disney studio, Walt formed his own company, WED Enterprises, because he found out the studio was not interested in participating in his idea of an amusement park. Nobody liked the idea at all.
I want to stop for a sec on that. What was the thought about that? Because these amusement parks existed. We talk about a Beverly Park where the Beverly Center is now. There was a amusement park. And there were, roving, not fairs. What's the word I'm looking for here?
Carnivals.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. But the idea of theme parks had been around, but it was not what it is. So when this is coming to light, what were people saying? And what really was your thought initially?
I didn't pay that much of attention, but I did like amusement parks because I was, all the little ones in around L.A.
Yeah.
I lived in Detroit for a year, and there was more amusement parks to explore. Little tiny
Busch Gardens, another one.
All kinds of little stuff. So I enjoyed that. And, of course, in my high school years, we want to make some trouble. We'd go down on Friday or Saturday nights to Ocean Park Pier. Your father probably had as much fun as I did
There you go.
Well, and so anyway, yes, around amusement parks, there was always, it's a lot of fun, all kinds of, stuff that we find out was not so good.
Right, right.
But then along comes a Walt Disney, who, he's animator. Then he gets into movies and television, because economically he has to do something, you know, after World War II.
Yeah.
And then it turns out his story was that basically in the 30s, he started taking his daughters to little amusement parks around town.
Yeah.
And generally they weren't very clean, but the little one out on Beverly Boulevard was kind of nice. Walt knew the guy very well.
Right.
So Walt was always a guy to go around and ask questions of people in small parks. He took his wife one day and he went all the way to Europe, and he went to Tivoli Gardens, which had been around like 200 years or something.
Okay.
Still there. And I think that was one of the seeds. The other one was when he was a little kid in Chicago, there was a big Chicago exposition that was filled with a new thing called electric lights. So somewhere he remembered that as a little kid. And then he was quite taken with Tivoli Gardens. And then the idea that can't find a place to take the two daughters. So he just sort of evolved into the idea, well, then I'll make my own park. And apparently his wife said, no, they're dirty. And Walt took offense, and it was basically, well, my park is going to be clean.
Right.
But then the studio, the financial people, oh, no, it's bad enough getting into television. You want to do an amusement park? So that was the set and setting. But Walt was not going, he's not a guy you'd stop him. He's going to do something.
Yeah, true, he'll visionary.
He'll find a way. So that's what I began to understand in early 1955, as his private company, Wed Enterprises, was collecting all these people.
Man, and was that, so the narrative around it, even internally, to a certain point, though, was like, oh, we're gritting our teeth. What's this really going to look like? What's this going to be? Right.
Yes. Well, that's it was strong enough. Negative thinking.
Yeah.
That's why he formed Wed Enterprises a few years before actually starting it.
Yeah.
Named for his father, Walter Elias Disney.
There's a quote that I want to bring up that you said, because you said negative thinking, right? So you said, and you told this to the LA Times, an article last year, think like a Buddhist, dream, wish, and hope are dangerous words. You get yourself thinking and set up for disappointment. Can you extrapolate on that a little bit and maybe apply it? And I know you know, the quote was from last year, but apply it to maybe in 1955 when the park was on the tip of everybody's imagination, and, or not on the tip of the imagination, but was starting to roll and get built and develop.
Well, I didn't see negative things about building and opening this park.
Yeah.
But by the end of the first week,
yeah,
after July 17th and the real day 18th, the place was falling apart. And particularly the little Autopia cars,
yeah,
that I was a car designer. I went to Art Center School.
Yeah.
And wound up working for Ford for a year,
right,
less than a year. I didn't know anything about engineering, but I had an auto shop in North Hollywood High. So, I'm fully qualified, yeah.
Right.
I found out within a week of Disneyland's opening, I needed to know a lot more.
Okay.
So I had basically 37 cars on the ride that were breaking down every day for different reasons. And from that spot onwards, it was like, now I was curious about why do things fail?
Yeah.
So the negative side of really good ideas was what I faced every day. And that ran through the full summer into fall of 1955.
Wow.
I didn't feel too bad because I find out some of the other attractions in the park that are big and complicated or risky were falling apart at the same time. Like the day after the opening, we had alligators running in water that had sand in it, and the metal parts were getting all chewed up, and the alligators went back to Burbank to be overhauled.
Oh, wow.
We couldn't take the cars off the track. I got my own car parked on the Disneyland ride.
Yeah.
Yeah, a yellow 51 Cadillac convertible with a trunk open with my own tools, repairing these broken cars. I mean, this was the pits of negativity.
Wow.
From something that was going to be glorious. Well, by going into 1956, the second year, we had solved most of the critical problems,
right,
and now we just had regular problems. And it was enough that Walt had ideas about more attractions that would be built in 56.
Yeah.
In fact, it was, I think, the end of 55, going into 56, Walt was always coming around to my office to talk to me. And he just casually said one day, he says, Robert, no, he says, Bobby, you know, this is the first year I didn't go broke. And it kind of stunned me. And he says, no, movies, you make the movie, you make the money, and then there's a big dip and it's all red. And then you come back up again. But the amusement park made it that it didn't dip into the red.
Wow.
And that was the clue this was going to work.
Interesting. Oh, man, right up. So yeah. Right off the bat, because it really was magic. And like, honestly, I had a phase where I grew out of the Disney mystique, you know, but then when you go back and you set foot into that, and I don't need to tell anybody who's watching this, but when you set foot in that park, I mean, it truly is this magical experience. And it's interesting note from day one, you know, there were problems and there were issues and you guys are figuring these things out. But did you know that it really was this beautiful experience that was going to be a revelation to the entire world?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I get this question all the time because let's say everybody who asked questions in the last 10 years or so, they're like second or third generation down and they've been living the magic. They didn't live the hell at the start of it. Okay. That was the difference. So the fact that those of us that were there starting even before the park was built, we do remember what it, that you have a great idea and all we can do this and all we can do this and we can build it, do stuff and buy stuff and put it all together. Oh, it's going to be beautiful, just like the pictures the artist made.
Yeah.
Uh-uh. That first year, yeah. Everybody had to suffer exactly the same way, finding out how to get everything to work. Little simple stuff. Let's say you have an expert person that lays out where the gardens and the walkways go.
Yeah.
We had a wonderful lady, Ruth Shellhorn. She did all that. Guess what? The real designers of where gardens and footpaths should go are the guests. They will walk to where it's convenient for them, so they trampled the gardens because it was shorter than following where the concrete went.
Yeah.
So these were the first, that was a good example, the first lessons.
Absolutely.
That we paid attention to what do guests actually do. And that was a big learning curve, which I believe made the difference between a regular carnival or a regular regional park. Walt was now, in sort of in hindsight, having to have overall master careful designs of things based on what empirically you're learning.
Yeah,
that had never happened before. And I think that's a big distinction that when you look at the other companies that got into amusement parks, you know, within 2 or 3 years, yes, a lot of them are folded quick. Those were the hard lessons learned, but they were learned by Walt's people. Not only the designers of Wet Enterprises, but the people who actually operate the parks themselves. That's where the learning curve came with what we would call park operations.
And it's so incredible to be able to absorb that and implement that because, you know, people, you know, there's customer service from the sense of, you know, oh, and I don't even know if these exist though, like leave your idea in a box that probably doesn't exist anymore, you know, of how you're going to improve the business. But some companies take it to heart. Some companies ignore it and just run things their way. But that's part of what ended up creating the magic. And it's not just feedback, but it's watching and seeing the experience and then learning how to improve on that. Let's talk about the rides. Let's talk about your impact.
Okay. Before we do I'm still working my way to answering your question a few minutes ago.
Go.
About did I ever visualize this was going to be a great, great, wonderful thing.
Yeah.
No, I only saw it personally from my view. Oh, my God, what have we got ourselves into here? You know, I'm worried about dead cars, you know.
Right.
I think we got to 56 before, 1956, before it kind of dawned on me, this whole thing might work long term. Because I think all through the summer, I thought, Well, we'll get to the end of the year and this thing will be a bust, like all the newspapers said, and then I'll go get a job with Industrial Design someplace, which was, you know, my thought of doing stuff. Because I did walk away from Industrial Design, which I was trained for. And then every year it got bigger and better and better and better, because every time Walt wanted new attractions, of course, I got my share of them. You know, it was always, as you said very early in the program, if it moved to Disneyland and it was on wheels, I probably did it. It was interesting. Walt gave different people different things he knew they loved to do.
Yeah.
And I'm the car guy. My heart was cars and airplanes, so it's logical. So that way Walt would go from, say, okay, Autopia car. Okay, we need a parking lot tram. Okay, we need a custom tractor for it. Okay, and all of that was before opening day.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Oh, we need an antique car on Main Street. Oh, well, we need another one. Well, we probably need a double-deck omnibus. Okay, we probably need a small train. All right, then we probably need a better railroad train. Oh, by 5 years later, oh, we finally are going to build our monorail. Now, that's a very short period of going from one thing that got bigger and bigger and more expensive and more dangerous, you know, on and on and on with big vehicles.
Right.
And as I look back at that period of time, I was wondering, you are not a trained engineer. You don't even know what stress analysis of steel is. And you're drawing pictures of this thing, the first monorail in the Western Hemisphere, because Walt wanted it. And we build it and we run it. And it's not very good. And so we have to go and improve it someday. All of this without skill, knowledge, or authorization, nothing more than Walt said, Bobby, I want you to get started on it. And he walked out of the room. He never told me any detail or anything. But guess what?
What?
Some designers are scared of being launched into something, not told exactly what to do.
Yeah.
There's other designers hand them a pencil and a white piece of paper. Oh, do you know what I can do? You know, I got an idea. It runs down my arm, runs on my pencil, and I put it on a piece of paper. And you do that over and over 100 times a day.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, something that's not visible suddenly becomes visible. And then pretty soon you spend money and you got materials and you buy parts. And pretty soon you got a whole train. It will just flow so fast out of your mind. I saw other designers do stuff the same way, like set design, animation, costume, all this stuff. And we were all doing it just like that.
It's incredible. I got to ask you, with all the cars, how much of that was from you growing up in Los Angeles, where this is the cradle of car culture?
Like, I told you early, cars and airplanes.
Yes. So,
because when I was about maybe 18 months old or so, the parents are always, is he going to say mama or dada?
Yeah.
It's very important. I said airplane. Cool. And my mother said my father was very disappointed. Yeah. I will recall cars that did not look like the regular cars. And I'm talking about if you're in 1933, 34, those are modern cars, 1933, 34. Yeah. I'm looking at cars that are 1920 or cars that are 1910 that somebody's taken care of.
Yeah.
Every time I saw one on a street where we lived, I ran over and I looked at the whole thing.
Wow.
Or sometimes there was a new car at the market two doors down. I'd go home, get my mother, drag her down. And look at the grill on the front of this car. It's leaning forward. Oh, my God. So in other words, there's a passion about cars. So that meant I'm hopelessly into every detail of cars. And then, of course, in high school, I'm drawing cars. And I'm drawing, actually, mechanical parts of cars. So in other words, by the time I'm 16, 17, I know a lot more about cars, sheet metal, structures, engines that a normal kid would know. You know, my stepfather taught me how to fix the clutch in my grandmother's Plymouth. Well, you do one clutch job. I can do a clutch job on any Ford V8, you know, just because you can do it, which gives you more knowledge.
Yeah.
And you just absorb it, but you never started to do that. But guess what? This is exactly what Walt Disney needed in the people doing all their different crafts in the park. And that's why I was kind of blown away by some of the people I met. And I says, these are all wizards. How can you figure out how to do that? People that could do rock work.
Yeah.
You know, people that could do beautiful drawings and make antique architecture look good. You know, even little animated characters, you know, like Mickey Mouse. The first Mickey Mouse was kind of weird looking.
A little bit, all through
the 30s in history, you look, the mouse kept getting better and better and better. And then pretty soon we got up to where we have a design sheet for a mouse that, forget what year, it really kind of got really good. It was after 55, I know that. Doing things the same way, you evolve and getting it better, 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 better. And that's what Walt did. I think that if you'd say in one set of words, what did everybody learn out of Walt Disney? It was simple. Just do it right.
Mm. And then combined with earlier, you mentioned curiosity. And you talk about passion, which are two extremely important ingredients into genuine success and just following through. And then with the experience and the hands-on, and you put those together, you know, you get a formula for success and for doing it right, because you have that curiosity, you have that passion, then you're doing it and you're gonna do it until it becomes what the vision is. Talk to me briefly. What were your thoughts on Los Angeles as a whole in that era, in the era you were growing up? Outside pre-Disney, like, did you realize anything about Los Angeles? What was the mood, the atmosphere? What were your thoughts on as an adolescent in Los Angeles?
Well, my first really strong memories, we lived on Cromwell Avenue, which was two blocks down from the street that Walt lived on. I didn't find that out till much later, of course. Beautiful green grass next to the sidewalk, gorgeous looking palm trees, expensive homes. Luckily, my grandmother, second husband, was quite wealthy and bought a really, really nice house in the Hollywood Hills. Yeah. So I lived from the time I was a few months old in a pretty elegant looking house. And everything I saw on the street, every place we got in the car and went someplace, everything was exciting looking, and it was neat. And after a few years, we moved in 1934 to Davis Avenue in Glendale, which was near the airport. And the airplanes, as they circle around the land, they go right over our house and school. Oh. So in other words, there were so many things that were so exciting to see. And like.
Yeah.
It wasn't until later, let's say after World War II, everything was being renewed and built and expanded. But I didn't realize until maybe going into the 70s, there were homeless people. There was graffiti. There was all the stuff we see today.
Right.
Just like driving down here today,
yeah.
I passed a cheap gas station. A cheap gas station. It was $6.17.
It's a steal. These days.
So I have to recognize the world changes all the time. But those first years, everything that I saw in L.A. was exciting. I remember the first time we went to the Coliseum. Oh, it was a classic looking thing as you walk around looking at it. And then once you're inside, you see how big that place is.
Yeah.
And the first time I actually saw something was a 4th of July show. Fireworks, you could hear the bombs echoing off the seats. And one day there was an automobile race there at night, and it was like, oh boy, this place is really neat. And then I found out what it was built for. There's stuff like that in L.A. And then, of course, the part during World War II was the best part. We had electric streetcars. We live in North Hollywood.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
My mother gives me some coins. Okay. Like on a Sunday. Okay. I get on a Chandler line, yeah, a red car, and I go over the Sepulveda Pass, and then I transfer to the Sunset Line, and then I go out to CBS.
Okay.
And I watch radio shows, wow, all afternoon. Now, when I'm tired of those, I walk back to NBC, and I go in and I watch NBC radio shows. Do you know how much fun it is to watch radio? The buildings were new. Everything was fresh.
Yeah.
The biggest thing the parents, at least my parents, would take me to, anything that cost nothing.
Yeah, of course.
Like the merry-go-round was a big one, Griffith Park. But my number one that I wanted to go all the time, she took me like once a month, the Griffith Planetarium.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Oh, there were so many science exhibits. A lot of them are all gone now, but they were just deeply, deeply interesting. And the building was like super slick, super modern.
Right.
I even went there one afternoon, and it was a little green round thing on a box, and it was called television, and it was Wrigley Field, and they were playing baseball.
Was it the L.A. Wrigley Field?
The L.A. Wrigley Field. Yeah. So, I'd say right up to the start of World War II, everything that was close by was so much fun, but I couldn't go any further than when my father would take us someplace, or my mother would.
Okay.
And then, but my grandmother drove me around more than everybody else. I mean, we had long trips, so I could see the whole world outside of L.A. But L.A. was, it had so many really, really neat things. And then it rapidly changed in 45. I mean, it built everything just built up as fast, and everything you remember got torn down.
Huh.
I'm coming down Whitsitt, crossing Burbank Boulevard. There was an orchard on the southeast side, nothing on the southwest side, and the walnut orchards were on the northwest side. There's four-story buildings on the corner of Burbank and Whitsitt.
This is the thing, man. This is why LA in a Minute exists, is because Los Angeles bulldozes its past. That's the, you know, we are the city of the future, you know, not to say Tomorrowland, if you will, but that's sort of an ethos that's permeated Los Angeles. Until very recently, I think we're doing a better job of trying to preserve the history and the, the buildings and the monuments that still exist, which I think is a great thing, obviously, to celebrate, acknowledge, and recognize that history. But let me ask you, do you ever see kind of a parallel in Disneyland as maybe freezing a moment in time to sort of capture that mystique of when you were younger and that Los Angeles where everything was beautiful and everything was exciting and meticulously maintained? Do you think that that's something that sort of why people enjoy Disneyland so much, or why they see that magic, is because when they go there, they're transported?
It depends on the age of the person.
Right, right.
And the reason I say that, if somebody, let's say your father's age and older,
yeah,
would have remembered the first 20 years of Disneyland. All right, the person that's 15 years old, and, you know, guy and a gal go down there and are teenagers, they see the park they see today, but they don't know anything that ever happened in the previous 70 years.
Fair.
But I am so old, I see the entire continuity of the entire thing.
Yeah.
It disappoints me a bit, but I have to couch it in the fact that I realize the world is changing. Disneyland's going to change, and Walt Disney said it's never going to be finished. Okay, so there's the factual set and setting. But when I look at old movies, 8mm color movies of Disneyland's first decade, I see the things that were so dear to me, just like the palm trees and the grass in the Los Feliz district on Cromwell. Right. Exactly the same way. And it's kind of wistful that I loved it. It's not there anymore. And it's, you remember Ralph's story on CBS?
Oh, yeah.
He made two VHSs all about the things that aren't here anymore. So Disneyland has large aspects of the things that aren't here anymore. And I know some people have an idea that says, well, we're going to make America great again. We're going to go back. We're going to restore stuff. I think the world has no reverse gear. It only runs in the forward direction. And that is a blunt fact.
Yeah.
So the Disneyland of today is an evolution of the previous decade, which is an evolution of the previous decade. And it's mixed with a little bit of magic, but at the same time, it's mixed in with financial reality of revenue.
Yeah.
There's no way to hide that fact.
There it is in this capitalistic society.
Right.
Absolutely.
And let me explore a little bit more on this question. Because I'm in a position that I get a bazillion questions wherever we go on the appearances that I make. And people know that they can ask me a question and I'll be pretty blunt and I'll give them, you know, my factual answer that might not be what they were looking for.
Right.
But people will say, oh, why does Disneyland cost so much? And somebody will show them a chart that why it costs so much, and then somebody has to explain it. And I'll say, just a minute, stop and think just a minute. You go into a line of business that's inside a warehouse. Do you know what the warehouse roof does? It keeps the rain and the ultraviolet from the sun, keeps it completely off your entertainment. If you build it outside, you have 24 hours a day with temperature changes, the humidity coming and going, the ultraviolet tearing everything to pieces. You do all of that. You build all of that. And that's before you even have somebody come and visit. You have a gigantic annual cost just because you put something in the ground that's gorgeous.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. All right. You got to pay for that first. Okay. All right. Then the next one is, the people you see, we call them cast members, you know, they're well-trained. They try to do a super job, make your day really good. So everybody's having a good time. What you don't see are the people in backstage trying to keep the place from crumbling in the ultraviolet and the rain and all that. So you got to pay for that.
Right.
Now you pay for the front. And you want to know, why does it cost so much to go in the front of the gate? You need to understand that. That part. I don't know how to avoid it.
And it's a thing. I have a friend who's a big theme park buff, and he posted a video. And this is not revelatory, but I think it's worth saying. You know, when you go to, and I don't want to mention competitors, but let's call it what it is, Magic Mountain, Six Flags, you know, things like that. Or for me, you know, Raging Waters, totally different, but same genre. They're great. They're fun. The rides are nice. And you have a good day. But you just see the peeling paint. You see the trash. You see the gum. You know, somebody stuck gum on somewhere. Maybe a little tagging or graffiti or something. And then at Disneyland, you know, the stories of, you know, 24-hour care and paint and keeping everything so meticulous. That is resources. That is people. That is cost.
Yes.
And that's something where, you know, like, yes, profit is a concern and shareholders and all this kind of stuff. But when you go and you're walking through that, you're like, this is truly incredibly maintained. And it does, there's no way around. There's no way to shortcut that. So I think that that's something that, you know, that you're kind of explaining. And that's just the parts that we see.
Well, I'll tell you why. The part, I guess what we should do someday is have special tours called the graveyard shift.
Okay.
Now, years and years ago, when we were testing the third generation of the monorail design, I said, we got to test this for a lot of miles. And so everybody agreed. And so I said, we're going to test this 24 hours a day, this first train, which didn't even have a body on it, just had a little cab on it. So we got it ready to test, and the guy said, okay, who's going to drive the graveyard shift for the first week? And they said, girl, you designed it. You test it. I spent a week. God, do you know how cold it is at night with a, you know, your eyes turn red from the fog, and I'm all by myself driving a monorail at a regular cycle around and around and around, but watching what goes on after closing until just before opening,
yeah,
the fleet of people, The hoses are washing everything.
Yeah.
Everything is cleaned and wiped and beautiful all night long. That's the part the guest never yeah. sees.
Yeah.
And that from the get-go, that's what they've always done in that park. It has to be.
Yeah.
But I've watched that for a week from a circulating monorail. You know,
so you had the bird's eye view of the reality of the situation.
I knew what that was like. In fact, just recently, Ernie and I were down there for something on the 27th, July 27th last year.
Yeah,
we got called in to do a little video gig for ABC, and this had to be early in the morning before it got light. And they said, well, we have to have special permissions for, you know, ABC crew, and because it's very dangerous. Why is it dangerous on Main Street? Well, we walk in there, and there's trucks and carts and people and hoses and tools, and there's people every which way, and ABC's in there trying to shoot some stuff, and then there's a crew that we're tagging along with trying to get me to, you know, not forget my lines of what I'm doing. And every few steps is, oh, watch this, watch that. Oh, that truck's backing up. Oh, they're unloading this stuff. And that's in that last 2 hours before the first guest will come in. And then we're all gone. Everything's gone. They never see that part.
It's like magic.
Yeah.
The only equivalent I have is at a grocery store. I don't know if you've ever been to a grocery store after they're closed and they're doing all the, you know, loading up of the aisles and everything. It's, again, not to that scale, but it's a completely different experience. You know, because grocery stores have to be extremely organized and neat and clean and all this kind of stuff. But when you see the behind the scenes and you're like, yes. Oh, man, a lot really goes into this that you're not necessarily thinking of all the time.
Yeah.
Let's go to the rides now. So, you know, I'm sure you've been asked this, but I got to ask. What ride that you created are you most proud of?
The fire engine on Main Street. Remember earlier, I told you Ward Kimball asked me to drive his 1916 American LaFrance fire engine.
Yeah.
That's a big old heavy car, right-hand drive, big old chef levers and everything on it. And that was always stuck in my mind. I thought, oh, man, I drove a fire engine when I'm, you know, 20 years old. And I'll never be rich enough to ever have one. But Walt, as I mentioned earlier, would come in my office and sit down in this old chair and chat a little bit or sometimes just not say anything. And it was at that moment. And I go, Walt, you know, we don't have a fire engine on Main Street anymore because we had the horse-drawn one, which was not practical, but it was authentic. And he goes, no, Bobby, we don't. And he walked out. And about 20 minutes later, the accounting lady from the accounting department phones me up. She says, Bob, write this number down. This is the authorization number for the new fire engine project. Walt went straight to accounting and got a charge number established for starting a fire engine project.
Yeah.
And I thought, whoopee, I'm going to get a fire engine. So that was, I got turned on so much to design that fire engine. And Ward Kimball could come over and look at my drawing, and he says, Bob, you don't have the front end quite right. Okay, you tell me how a fire engine ought to look. And he told me how it ought to look. I'll make it exactly that way. Okay, so I did.
Yeah.
Where are we going to get all the parts, antique parts for a fire engine? That's going to be like a 1905 fire engine, something, or 1910, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
I go down to Crown Coach Company in L.A. because they build school buses, a local company. And then they got a fire coach division, a guy by the name of Red Wilmar. And I says, Red, what do you got in fire engine antique equipment? And I said, well, cool, I'm going to build a fire engine for Disneyland. And he shows me a 1938 Chevy, it was like a small pumper type truck.
Yeah.
And they just took it in on trade for something else. But it had all these antique parts and pump things, all this cool stuff. You have had pipe poles on it and the hoses, everything, and a ladder was in it. I said, how much? He said, $150, you can have it. So I bought it, and we managed to get it out to the studio, driving it. The radiator was leaking and all that. So when you go to that Disneyland and you see all that stuff on the Disneyland fire engine, the one in Walt Disney World, where they had to find similar stuff, but the Disneyland one, that's real working stuff that came off of a 38 Chevy.
Okay. That is awesome.
So the rest of it, it's easy to build an antique car. It really, really is. So it was the same kind of chassis as the red car and the yellow car. But that's my fire engine, yes. In fact, the way I can tell it's mine is that the fire engine has a stop at City Hall and has a stop up at the castle. And you dare not ever stop that between those two stops, and for no reason at all. But some of the drivers know me very well.
Right.
And if I stand in the street, they'll stop and pick me up. Hey. But the management knows that, oh, did Bob make you stop again? Well, try to avoid that.
I think you get some special privileges,
yeah,
I would say.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, yeah.
Okay, talk to me about the Matterhorn, because that was one of my favorite growing up. And one thing that stood out in my research was you were actually the first person to ride the Matterhorn, which, you know, I want to know, like, what goes into the design and all that kind of thing. But I also, I'm like, you know, you never want to be that crash test dummy, for lack of a better term. But what is it like? I guess a little bit about the creation process and putting together an actual, you know, roller coaster and all this kind of stuff. But also, like, you got to go first and you got to test it. How is that? How did that feel?
Okay. Well, it's best to back up to the design. How did Walt start?
Yeah.
Well, it's a kind of a complicated story how we wanted a Matterhorn. But we wanted a Matterhorn, and the design got developed and went Enterprises where they styled the mountain first.
Okay.
And it had a lot of design work to get it to sort of look, it was about 3 feet tall, you know, model of it. And then Walt calls me over and says, well, we've decided on the shape of the mountain and all these little holes in it and things and waterfalls. And he says, we're going to put a roller coaster in here. And we got a company up north that is going to build the roller coaster and install it in the building. And they are waiting for the design of the track, and I want you to design the track.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, put two tracks in there, and then he walks away. Now, background.
He did a lot of walking away, huh? He just dropped a lot of ideas.
Background,
yeah.
I do not like roller coasters, and I've never ridden one.
Okay.
Okay, but Walt said, you know, a day or so later, he says, well, to learn more about them, go down to Ocean Park and ride that one. So I went down there with my little boy, and we rode it once. But I was more taken with the Wildermaus rides, because in the sunlight, the wheels scrape, and I see little metal shavings coming off and things. And I thought, oh, I don't want anything to do with a roller coaster, but I've got to design a track.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the set and setting. I start to design a roller coaster, and there's only one dimension I needed, and the company was going to build it,
okay. Gave
me a number. And that number has to do with a slope called a neutral slope. That is to say, and this is for all you coaster enthusiasts that need to know this, neutral slope means if you have a vehicle that is standing still, you know, the type of wheels, type of track, everything, it will not move. And if it's moving, say, 25 miles per hour, it will never change its speed. It'll continue. That is neutral slope, and it's a number like 0.035 or some such number.
Yeah.
A roller coaster is good because you can always go down, but you can't come back up above the neutral line. So
okay. Each
dip gets lower and lower and lower. All right. Now, Aero Development, the engineers that designed that track, they had never built a roller coaster. They came up with the cleverest thing I ever saw. When you ride that car, you ride in the front of the car, every time you come to a hill, you'll see a spinning wheel.
Okay. I see that. I know what you're
saying. That's a rubber tire with a kind of a flywheel effect on it. And the bottom of the car has a flat thing called a platen. Okay. If a car, see, the cars are subject to a variable speed depending on the oil in the wheels, the temperature, time of day, the weight of people. There's all these variants.
So interesting. That stuff I never think about, but it makes
perfect
sense.
Yeah, you never think about that.
Yeah.
Okay, what if a car is too slow and it crested out? Which roller coasters will do?
Wow.
But not Matterhorn.
Right.
If the car was a little slow, and these wheels catch it and give it a little bit more energy to go over the hill. Same way if it's going too fast and a big dip or the turn in or something like that. Oh, it slowed down a bit.
Right.
And we call that booster brake.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Okay. So, makes sense.
All right. Now, I design a track. I start designing the track. Do you know how much mathematics is involved in this? Every time, so I had, to calculate every 3 feet, what is the velocity, rate of velocity change in X-cell to D-cell, and every time you make a turn, the car is going to bank, what's going to be the bank angle, which you can't do unless you know the speed, and you won't know the speed unless you calculate it.
This is when I checked out of math, by
okay.
the way.
All right.
Learning all these
all
kind
right.
of, yeah, go on.
All right. Over at North Hollywood High, geometry one, a pass and a fail.
Okay. Good.
Mr. Gordy said, I don't want to see Robert again. He doesn't get it. I got no more math in my life. I taught myself trig in 15 minutes.
Come on.
Because I had a little booklet with numbers in it.
Yeah.
And they have a picture of a circle and a triangle with a bunch of Greek names.
Uh-huh.
You know, hypotenuse and all that stuff. Truly, you can learn a trigonometry in 15 minutes by looking at a chart. Okay, now I got the tool. So I designed this whole thing, and then they build it and install it, and then we get it down to where we had some hay bales,
okay.
you know, before the water pond. And I was down there one day with my little boy and my boss. He says, Robert, you design it, you ride it. So I found out later, ride was successful. I learned later they said, we got Gerd right where we want and pull the hay bales out from front of the track. Yeah. Well, we survived it.
Survived and thrived.
Well, finished the track, put it together, and then we had a bunch of executives who ride it, you know. So we got a bunch of executives with suits and ties that I rode it first. Said, yeah, buddy, you didn't ride that one first because you with the hay bales, you know.
Were there any big failures that you... I don't even want to call it regret, but if there are, but any failures of projects that you worked on that didn't come out that you really wish would have worked or would have performed or would have come to light?
No, there was the ones that I would call failure were things that consistently did not, they were difficult to improve them.
Yeah.
It was because there were fundamental aspects of a vehicle design. The 1959 monorail was a prime example. That was the first monorail, and you know, I told you how we designed it.
Yeah.
I just drew it. I was highly involved in every detail of it, the building of it. I was a test driver, all this kind of stuff. But it was the first design, and it did function, but it did not function as well as I thought it would, because that's a new machine to us and new machine to me and Walt. So I watched it over a number of years, and I could see why things fail, but also why things fail to be improvable.
Right.
There's a fine difference there.
Yeah.
So by 1964, about August, I had come to the conclusion the Mark I monorail cannot be improved any further to improve its function because the beam way is built different than we had thought. It's not a curve. It's a set of two feet of flat. So there's little tiny kinks in the concrete, which was like wiggling the train like mad.
Yeah.
The train was just not liking that. Okay. So I took a deep breath and said, let's get a budget going and I'll start a really, really, really good design because it doesn't have this have to get built by a date like the first one.
Right.
So that became the Mark III monorail, which turned out to be a superb running machine. And that was the basis for the big Mark IV for Florida opening. And those chassis ran very well because I could find out what's wrong with something, fundamentals, and then design the next machine to have the fundamentals that can be worked with.
Right.
And optimize a little bit. So it's hard to say failure.
Yeah.
Although there was one big failure that did scare me, we had a little streamlined train called the V-Liner. And it had a small black Chevy in it with a Jeep transfer case to have all-wheel drive. So it had a drive shaft going out the back and drive shaft going out the front. So you got a drop case and you got this differential in the front. A leading drive shaft is only as good as the U-joint.
Okay.
And after some number of months, I got a phone call and they said, Kerr, come down here. We lost the drive shaft. Anybody who drives a truck or something, you don't ever want the drive shaft to fall nose down into railroad ties, because that would flip the train right off the track.
Okay.
And all this thing did was skip and bounce until it stopped. And that's the one that put my hair on end, that said, Kerr, you need to figure every failure mode that could ever happen on anything you ever do from now on. So that was the one thing. And like I say, the truck guy will know you dropped a forward drive shaft. You could kill people.
Yeah, and that was
so. That was the big learning. But that's the only failure that really scared me.
Interesting. Yeah. And I know, we could.
You didn't hear any of that. So the story, it never happened. Sorry.
No, I know we could be here all day and there's so many things to cover, but I do want to start wrapping up just to honor your time and everything. But I want to talk about two things that were non-Disney related. Number one, the King Kong at Universal Studios. You were integral in that creation. How did that relationship start and how did that come to light? How did that end up happening?
Well, Disney fired me, and within less than 2 weeks, I had formed the Gurr Design Incorporated and hired myself. So I'm a free agent, and of course, Universal calls and says, oh, we got this King Kong project. We want you on it. Okay. So it involved a great number of people, over several years, and then it got really serious. Okay, we're going to build a 30-foot-tall animated gorilla.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, a couple of years before, they said, oh, we need a 24-foot-tall fire-breathing dragon and an elevator and a pit. Can you do that really fast? Yeah. Why not? Fire-breathing dragon, yes. And that was the Conan Sword and Sorcery show. It had the most fabulous-looking flames coming out of this dragon, And it was a real, real simple machine mechanically. Okay. So now we take a look at King Kong. Here's a hint about something. Oh, this is important. Sometimes you have a design and you make a maquette of it. And if you have a little maquette and then you're going to make it mechanical, don't ever blow it up literally in scale. Every time you go up in scale, you're losing the opportunity to remember what design is optimized for any scale. If you blow up the King Kong literally, it's a big, heavy machine, terribly expensive. But if you blow it up in size and then take a look at it, what is the least amount of mechanical parts to hold up the biggest pile of fur?
Right, right.
660 pounds of fur, gorilla fur. Minimum amount of body, minimum amount of actuators and stuff. So it looks like a real gorilla to anybody riding in the tram.
Absolutely.
The tram car tips and it slides right into the gorilla's mouth, scares the daylights out of all the little kids. Okay, the machine is so simple because you can understand what you ought to do in as designs get bigger.
Yeah.
A lot of guys still don't get that, but that was a simple machine that would really work well. I'm so glad it died in a fire in New York City. I think it was 2008, I think.
Okay.
The valley was covered in black smoke. Somebody says, oh, your gorilla just burned up. Oh. Well, okay.
Wow.
You know why I'm happy?
Why?
Normally, an attraction, after some number of years, you'll take it apart and it's cut up and gone to the junkyard.
Yeah.
That's a terrible thing to do to a designer.
Right. Oh,
okay. You see that?
It's a piece of you. Yeah.
However, just like James Dean became so famous after he lost his life.
Wow. Yeah.
People still celebrate James Dean. They buy red jackets and all that kind of stuff.
Of course, of course.
At age 22, James Dean, I met him. I work with him with sports car races. Okay. King Kong went out in a blaze of glory at age 22 in New York City.
There you go.
That is a piece of history. It's permanent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That was my gorilla, yeah.
That's interesting. That's a good. Okay, one other project. The 1984 Olympics closing ceremony flying saucer. I wish I removed it. My production team advised, but I have a pennant of the 84 Olympics because I actually went to the 84 Olympics with my dad, one of my first formative memories. But I'm a big Olympics guy. LA 28's coming up. I'm excited. I do work with them. But you designed the Olympics closing ceremony flying saucer. How'd you hook up with the Olympics? And tell us about the flying saucer.
Okay. I'm doing lighting for Michael Jackson for the Victory Tour.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
And that is a 9-week high speed $250,000 job. Okay. And we're working every day with the rehearsals of the thing down at Zoetrope Studio. Then pretty soon we do the first load in down in Alabama. And the guy that designed the stage for Michael, John McGraw, an absolute whiz at stage design, would pull me aside a couple times a day. Say, if you were to ever do a flying saucer, how would you do this? How would you do that? Never told me what he's doing.
Yeah, okay.
And then when I fly back home here, he calls me up and he says, would you like to do a flying saucer job? The money's gone. Our guys, they paid us the money, but it went up somebody's nose. That's the problem.
1980s. Yeah.
And I'm going bankrupt. And all the vendors are hanging and haven't been paid. So I took this train wreck.
Yeah.
You got 5 weeks. Figure out a flying saucer. Oh, all this stuff. First off, polish all the vendors. Just tell them you'll promise to get paid somehow. And I had to set up a business deal between the Gurr Design Company, the Broglie Company, and UPS down at the Hughes Airport, down by the marina, all in a matter of 2 or 3 days. So we got a business flow. And keep going, design as fast as you can go, and come up with something that we had to test it. And of course, it crashed on its test flight on the first one. We figured out what's wrong, fixed it. Now we start testing it down there in the middle of the night before the Olympics.
Yeah.
And it was the darnest thing, the fastest, riskiest thing I ever did, and we didn't have a lick of trouble with it.
Wow.
Sometimes a machine will behave so good.
Yeah.
But it astounded people. People can still go on the internet. You'll still see it. There's videos of it.
Yeah.
People are still thinking that was the Martians.
Which is a testament to your ability.
Yeah, because some people know how we did it. Other people say, no, it could not have been done that way. Because the way it was staged, the people that are going to operate it, this is David Walper, and he had a technical audio crew that was doing it. We were working with them for operations.
Yeah.
But meantime, we were putting it together and testing it on Figueroa Street in front of the sports arena. Anyway, the fact that somebody decided to make a show out of this, working for David Walper.
Yeah.
How do you get it in the air without seeing it? Have a helicopter that will paint black and get the FAA to approve. And we put, paint it flat, black, night before.
Yeah.
Get a approval of the FAA, run it with no lights. Then we'll hire 2 police helicopters and keep all the lights on. There'll be 3 helicopters in the air. You see the 2. You don't know there's a 3rd helicopter.
Wow.
I went out and I bought I bought 100 foot of a half inch cable and 3 bridle cables, so it's bridled. And we hook it up. So 100 feet up with a cable on a black helicopter, all the guests saw in the sports arena, in the Coliseum, was the Martians, and the police are trying to arrest it and they're not stopping, not killing it.
That's incredible.
And you got 90,000 people are all drunk drinking beer. See,
spectacle.
You design a show.
Yeah.
And then you figure out machinery. What kind of machinery can we get away with and do it in 5 weeks and make a profit?
Wow.
Yeah.
You make it sound easy, though. You make it sound so easy.
Well, by that time, I'd done an awful lot of stuff. And of course, you know, kept on doing a couple more stuff. And then pretty soon, they're sinking ship in Las Vegas. That was...
Oh, Treasure Island, right?
Yeah, Treasure Island,
yeah.
The pirate battle show. Yeah, that was... See, you have to have an entrepreneur who wants something, but he can get a writer to write a story about it. And then you get an artist to draw a picture. Where are you going to find somebody to do a crazy idea? That was all the reasons why never to do it. Every job I ever did, starting with Autopia Car, I did 100 jobs for Walt, 150 for everybody else. Not one repeated.
Yeah.
I never got good at anything.
Because
everyone was different. And you learn from every single one of those.
And that's where that curiosity
curiosity
and the passion is the formula.
Okay, now I'll tell you the backup story.
Okay.
This is Ventura and Whitsitt.
Yeah.
Go down this street to Rhodes Avenue.
Okay.
Now, before that was called Rhodes Street, that was called Taylor Walk.
Okay, okay.
Tail or walk.
Wait, really?
Your father would have known it. Oh, okay. A mile north of here, just west of Whitsitt, on Burbank Boulevard, at 12614 Burbank Boulevard, we moved there from Glendale in 1939, and we stayed until 1949. My mother told me one day, she says, you're going to go to college. I've sold the house. Go find a boarding house. Okay? So, okay, all right. So I had 10 years in the valley.
Yeah.
From third grade to 12th grade.
Yeah.
In the valley.
Yeah.
In North Hollywood and Studio City. You go down half a mile that way on the northeast corner of Ventura and Laurel Canyon.
Okay.
In front of the drugstore.
Yeah.
A bus from L.A. comes out and throws a big bundle of newspapers. I'm a carrier boy for Hollywood Citizen News. Every 5 days a week, I ride from North Hollywood High with my bike, and I sit and I wait for a certain number bus, and the guy throws a bundle on the sidewalk. I fold my papers and do my route, which starts at Whitsitt Moore Park and goes north and west.
Wow. Okay.
I later on in World War II, this was 1943.
Yeah.
Then I added several more paper routes. As other kids quit, I took them. I'm buying war bonds. $18 bucks, I'll sell them for 25 when the war is over. Yeah. So I went into business in 1943. My stepfather, I told him, I want a bicycle. Get a paper route, then you can get a bicycle. Okay, so. And I delivered papers long enough that I had restored my 31 Ford five window, customized it.
Dang.
Still throwing papers. Yes.
Pretty the entrepreneurship.
Yeah. So all around this whole valley, I watched this whole valley change.
Yeah. Firsthand.
We used to have steam trains to Reseda.
Come on.
In the middle of the night. I loved going to the movies or hanging out on Lancashire Boulevard at either the El Patel Theater or the Valley and go up to get the streetcar to go home, get off at Whitsitt and then walk home from there because they had a big steam engine that had to pull over and wait for the streetcar to go by, and I could walk up to this glowing, steaming, hot steam engine.
Yeah.
You know, and then in the middle of the night, you hear it because it goes up and it goes back to L.A., delivering everything for the West Valley by steam train. Oh, yeah. The valley was good. And World War II, at Thornton Avenue and Hollywood Way, there was 93,000 people working there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, building airplanes for the war.
Didn't know it was that many people, but yeah.
I was at... Riverside Drive School,
okay.
Third grade, part way. Teachers threw me out. I drew cars and airplanes on my test papers.
Okay, okay.
The principal of school personally drove me home rather than sending me home with a note to talk to my mother privately.
Right, right.
A couple of days later, my grandmother informed me I'm being sent to Burbank Military Academy as incorrigible. This was so good. It was off runway 8 at Burbank.
Oh.
P-38s taking off. They built P-38s. They built Hudson bombers. They're building all this stuff. Sky is full of airplanes. My paper route's full of airplanes. There were vacant lots on some of my paper routes, and there was Grand Central Air Terminal.
Yeah.
They had Boeing cadet biplanes, and all the kids learn how to fly airplanes. Something goes wrong with the airplane, they land on a field. There were plenty of fields. The planes come down, and they fall over backwards, and it's upside down. A guy gets out and thumbs a ride back to the airport.
Wow, so you must have been in heaven. You were loving this. This is formative stuff right here.
10 minutes in the valley, 10 years in the valley here.
Wow.
All of this right here.
That's incredible. Yeah. And again, now me, I walk these streets every day. You know that my house is very close to the studio, and quite a different experience. Slightly different valley. Not as many open fields.
Well, I have quite a few snapshots of the valley in 47.
Yeah.
And one of these days, I swear, I'm going to go out and reshoot every one of those locations.
That's an incredible project.
Also, if you go up Whitsitt to Riverside, where there's a river, there was no river channel. Whitsitt and Riverside was a low spot.
Okay.
The northeast corner was a swamp.
Really?
Full of frogs and polywogs.
Northeast corner.
Yeah, northeast corner. Okay.
That's about where Val Surf is, roughly. Yeah.
And on the southeast corner, up a little bit from where that's called a wash.
Yeah.
Was Cody Spahn's movie stables. And it was a yellow and green place full of horses.
Come on.
There was, Radford Studios used to be what was the original name of that.
Yeah.
Everybody rented, they were doing Westerns.
Yeah.
And Cody Spahn had all the movie horses.
Like Spahn's Ranch.
Across the river, across the wash, the other side was the Weather Wax dog training studio for movies. And then the paper out, my paper out number 1821, 1519 was further west. When you collect the money every month, you have to ride around on a bike at night to catch people at home.
Okay.
Full of movie stars. Lon Chaney Jr.
Yes.
Smiley Burnett working with Gene Autry.
Yeah.
All these people.
Right here in the valley,
Yeah, this was Studio City. Yeah, mm-hmm. This whole thing.
Studio City. That's
and they all got rich and moved to Calabasas. Yeah, the valley was, and this the first part of the L.A. Wash, that was not paved. They didn't start paving that till 54.
Okay, I did not know that.
The best place to catch a crawdads was at Coldwater, the bridge at Coldwater. Yeah, you go down there and catch crawdads.
Fishing in the San Fernando Valley.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah, this place was really something.
Dang. Well, it still is. Just a different something, you know. But
Well, anyway, this was I knew from your personality that we just have a good time.
Well, thank you. Yeah. A great time.
Because you... You can lay out your questions as not a detailed question, a broad question.
Yeah.
That's a big difference.
I try. I try to cover the bigger topics, but, you got to let the conversation go where it's going to go.
I had another one. The guy, what was his name? Jason somebody. He had a show called Build Your Brand.
Okay.
A very business-like thing.
Yeah.
But the guy was a little bit like you in that he would not ask a direct question. He'd start a conversation, and then you'd mention something, and he says, well, tell me about that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he just waits. Okay, and he gave people all the time in the world. then that all that did was leave him these little notes that he put in his head that left him another hour of tell me about. Was not a question.
Right, right.
Yeah.
We got to let the guests shine, right?
Yeah.
You have your memory, unbelievable, by the way. And so you got to pull those memories out. Just tell me, give you the floor.
I have no idea why I can remember names and part numbers and going way back on stuff, but it's like it got in there good and it comes out good. Yeah, there's something.
That's a gift.
It's like, you know, I got some physical ailments and stuff, but every doctor at Kaiser, they ask me the same thing at the end before I go out the door. I've never met anybody like you. How do you do this? And I keep thinking, you're a doctor. You're supposed to figure that out.
You're supposed to be telling me and then telling other patients how to do this.
Yeah. The only way I think I've seen so many people that are like this. I have a friend who's a lady friend. She's 105 up in Pacific Grove. She is like talking to a 70-year-old when I talk to Elizabeth. Yeah. There's some people, they just keep right on going. I think it's the people that all their thoughts are outside of themselves, not internal.
You think like
about
a cathartic
that.
Release almost, if you will, or what do you think it is?
I think it's an inherent thing to people evolve, or they haven't to begin with, and it's probably curiosity driven. If you were to technically ask somebody the question, then technically they'd answer it. It says, why would I have thoughts about me when the whole world is there and I'd like to have thoughts about that? It's as simple as that.
Interesting.
And I think you get into a rhythm of everything outside me is so interesting that, yes, I've got complaints I could complain about. What do most old people do?
I mean, the trope.
Oh, let me tell you about what the doctor told me. Oh, my God. Oh, I've got this and I've got that. And oh, no. Yeah, and then nobody wants to listen to them. Yeah. So I'm not your regular 94-year-old.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
And it's curious because I had a teacher once said, you know, I get old and I look in the mirror and I see the face and I see the wrinkles, but my side of the eyeballs looking out look the same. And I think that's the externalness that some people just have it. Because I see a lot of people like that.
That's incredible.
I just happen to be one of them, that's all.
I think also DNA and genetics is probably play a little bit of a part.
Well, yeah, the DNA, there's no getting around the DNA.
Yeah.
That's the written specification. And I'll tell you why. You go to a Disney event. The parents will bring some child from, you know, 8 years old to 20 years old or whatever, and say, oh, my child wants to be an Imagineer. What can you tell them? What can you suggest? And I get so tired doing this because it's guaranteed. Isn't that right, Ernie? That's question number one with everybody. So I finally shifted gears a little bit, and I got kind of test people. Okay. So my serious answers are always, my child wants to be an Imagineer.
Yeah.
And then I'll look at the child, whatever age it is, and I'll suddenly go, what turned you on at 5 years old? All right? Because I get two answers.
Yeah.
There's only two. The child will go, oh, what did that old man say? or I get, oh, my God, I love this. I love that. Oh, yeah. And then I look at the mother, and the mother says, oh, tell me about it. Yeah.
Wow.
You see that difference?
Yeah,
you get that in an instant.
Yeah. There's the passion again.
Yeah. See, there's the passion.
Man.
And then, okay, now we got a conversation going.
Yeah.
The two parents are paying attention because they just saw their child light up.
Right.
Okay. Or not light up. Okay. Now, when they say, well, what should my child do? And then I don't talk to the parent anymore. I look at the child and I say, well, first off, you've got to choose your parents well because you want to get some DNA you could do something with. And then I look at the parent and says, "Oh, it was a sharp cut, Mr. Gurr." But this is truth.
Yeah.
This is solid truth. Now that we got the DNA out of the way.
Yeah.
That's a serious stuff. And then the next one is, do you have curiosity or do you know what it is? And that's a yes or no. They'll right. Curious. Oh, God, I got to learn about this. I got to learn about that. And then the father or mother will say, oh, we have to drag him here and we have to drag him there because he wants to do something.
Yeah.
Ah, you got a live wire. Okay. But you can do that. And in 2 or 3 minutes, you can just size up somebody just like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
And then you watch them over a period of years. They'll flourish and they get older and then they'll call again or they come. We got what? People from San Diego area? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the kid wanted, he was a little kid with big eyes and big questions a long time ago. And now he's a big, tall kid with big eyes, but he's done over 1,000 travel videos. He's a video editor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go, man.
Yeah, and there's another guy. This is the one from Oceanside, the one the mother drove up here.
Uh-huh.
We go to the barn because we have the bus tour. We go to Walt Disney's barn.
Yeah.
And you meet all kinds of people and they all want to talk to you. And this one kid walks up very quiet, very polite, and then has a smartphone. He says, I'm interested in Disney animation. He's showing him and he's really good drawing animation. And then I think a second year, he said, would it be all right sometime if we came to visit you and have some questions.
Okay.
Well, okay. She drives him up, gets out of the car. He's in a double-breasted suit and tie. Hey, what, 15, 16, something like
yeah.
that. And at lunchtime of nothing but questions, just serious, serious questions.
Good. Yeah.
Then I get a call the other day from him, and he says, I now have 35,000 followers.
Okay.
Oh. He says, I have a proposal. Would you like to do I think it's like a coordination thing of opposite artists? He says, I edit my own TikToks. I do the 1, 3, and 6 minute or the 10 or whatever it is. And he says he does all the editing and everything, and he posts this stuff. And he says, what if we did something where you are not an animator, but I will teach you how to draw Mickey Mouse? And he says, I am not an industrial designer. Would you teach me how to design from the aspects of understanding light and shape? I thought that was an interesting...
Good trade.
Yeah. Yeah, he could do that on a TikTok thing.
That's incredible, actually.
Yeah, and he says some future date we might figure it out. He says, I drive now. He's got I think his uncle gave him a 59 Ford truck. He restored
really?
It, yeah, and he rebuilt the engine and stuff. And he says, I'll drive up and I'll bring all my materials. And he says, why don't we shoot enough footage that I could do maybe 3 or 4 edits for posting later?
Yeah.
But yeah, you find kids that are that smart.
See,
and then
as
they get older, you start to see that they do flourish.
Got to be industrious. And again, it goes back to the passion.
Yeah. So anyway, we had a preliminary conversation, those logistical steps, how this thing might work. What would we have to do that? And I thought, I might enjoy having somebody show me how I could draw a Mickey Mouse head. That's like something, I can't do any of that, but maybe this guy is smart enough to show me. And I know for sure I can show him the essence of lighting.
Well, that's you. Yeah,
the use of light, the use of reflection, and maybe design something like a beautiful coffee pot or something like that. Where it's just pure industrial design.
Man.
Yeah. So we'll see.
Too bad I don't have any skills like that to trade. Just
yeah.
the question.
Well, this, yeah,
just
this
the question asking.
This would be a TikTok trade.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be kind of funny.
That is a good one.
Yeah, and then you got somebody that's really young and somebody that's really old.
That's what's cute about it.
Yeah,
that's
each is a teacher. Each is a teacher. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially. Well, anyway.
Yeah. All right. Two last things. So we sort of led with your legacy and talked about, you know, without a doubt, you're one of the most important people, not just in the Disney universe, but just as far as creating people's experience. You know, everything's experiential these days. And you had such a big contribution to that. There's the Bob Gurr Living by Design documentary. I got to know, how did that feel to have your life story, you know, kind of told on the big screen and you know, memorialized in that sense?
Well, funny thing is, somehow I saw around a movie studio what it's like when ego gets out of control.
Yeah.
And I just started to make a mental note, I don't ever want to go down a path like that. So as time went by, people obviously were wondering, how does Gurr do that? On and on and on. And I just treated it as, well, that's what I do. An entrepreneur wants a cuckoo idea, I'll do the cuckoo thing, because it's, you know, I like to do that stuff, you know. So I never, and of course there was people who wanted, there's sloppy YouTube stuff going way back, stuff. And then pretty soon everybody's got a video. Look, I'm talking to you.
Right.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's just sort of like, well, that's what people, curious people do. And then there's other curious guys want to know, well, how did you do that? But I never see that as a big deal, let's say.
Yeah.
So this movie came about after quite a few years of saying no to everybody. And then finally I got boxed into a position where I kept saying no, but they said, well, we're going to proceed. Well, no, well, we're going to proceed. And finally, you got kind of blunt where it says, okay, guys, I'll go with you.
All right.
Just give me the location and my call time and costume, and I'll be there. So I tried vividly not to try to influence anything.
Right.
No production notes until the day after the premiere. I did have some words with the director. I did get a production note, but it's too late now. But anyway, it was a little tiny fix.
Right.
So at the premiere, it was kind of funny to sit in the Alex Theater in Glendale.
Yeah, beautiful.
Which had a four court.
Beautiful.
Had a four court. It was a half a block north of my father's store. And my little sister and I, when we were 7, 8 years old, we used to run around and play in the four court. I knew that theater so well inside.
Yeah.
But to look at a movie with me on a screen at the Alex with these memories of, I was a little kid running around this joint, was a kind of startling. And then I kind of got used to, I've seen it several times before, and every time I look at this movie, it gets longer.
Yeah.
Wow. So I'm sorry to report that I can't sit there like a Hollywood star and do a bunch of braggadocio. But I appreciate the gesture. It was very, very nice. And it turned out the director is and the producer, of course, and the people that worked on it, they put their hearts in it. And it's an interesting story told in a very interesting way.
Yes.
That I think a couple more years, I might look and say, oh, it was pretty cool. I should have said yes.
Think it is pretty cool, Living by Design. And then you were also in this Disneyland Handcrafted, which again, we have the giveaway for that featured you with the 70-year anniversary and all that. And upcoming, you have the Charles Phoenix, by the way, great, great guy, historian of Los Angeles and beyond. Just really tell some good stories with some interesting people. Big retro Disneyland slideshow and Bob Gurr tribute at Bowers Museum in Santa Ana. And that's on May 3rd. How'd you hook up with Charles? I mean, he's known. So I'm sure you guys ran.
Oh, I've known him for years because he's a singular, spectacular L.A.-based comedian historian of the first order.
Well said.
There's no way anybody I have ever seen anywhere close to the skill, showmanship, choice of clothes, and the fact that
style.
He is collecting
style.
And sharing Americana.
Yeah.
He buys thousands of little slides from from sales everywhere.
Right.
And he's got them all collated, and he's a car guy.
Oh.
His father ran two used car lots. The little kid running around looking at chrome grills, and he knows all the cars, you know.
Interesting.
So he is a storyteller of the first order. So when I'm on stage with him, I am so humbled.
Yeah.
Because it's like, he sails way past me. But he has a way of asking me questions that it turns out to be a sarcastic barb that is so funny.
Yeah. Oh,
so he is a thrill to share a stage with. Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, it's a thrill to be here with you, even in the studio. Appreciate your energy, that curiosity, and that passion. I got to tell you, that's what I try to instill in my son. You know, curiosity and passion, because, you know, intelligence, athleticism, you know, all these other qualities can be important in different ways. But when you have curiosity and you have passion, you're going to succeed because you can apply that to whatever it is in any kind of different field. You are the epitome of that. You've accomplished so much and you've done so much for us. Los Angeles, Disneyland, Universal, Vegas, the Olympics, all that. I just really want to thank you for everything. And thank you so much for being here.
Great questions. I enjoy helping you all the time. Yes. Thank you very much, Evan.
Well, thank you again. One of the original Imagineers.
Right.
One of the most special and impactful people in the world. The theme parks, amusement parks. I mean, this is Bob Gurr. Thank you so much, Bob Gurr. And you are a treasure for Los Angeles and beyond.
Thank you very much. All right.
All right, LA. It's been a minute. All right. Now, as promised, we have our giveaway. So let me show you what our giveaway is and what you need to do to qualify. Check this out. Thank you, Disney, for sending us this Disneyland handcrafted, their documentary package gift box. Leslie Iwerks Film, celebrating the 70th anniversary of Disney. And of course, Bob Gurr had a great big hand in all of this. So he thought this was appropriate. The winner will be announced on Friday. And what do you need to do to qualify? You need to like this podcast. You need to subscribe to my channel. And you need to comment your favorite Bob Gurr designed ride. We've talked about some of the rides already. Bob has talked about them. But you can also just look it up on the internet. It's in the first paragraph of his wiki. And there's some of the classics. So that's all you got to do. Now, as far as what's in the box, take a look at this. First and foremost, Disney travel mug, 70th anniversary, high quality, gorgeous, cute. Speaking of cute, we got this Mickey plush, 70th anniversary with his pennant, of course, Disneyland 70. We have some Disney Main Street kettle corn, right? Your nice little package to enjoy. And last but not least, we have the Big D. Little pillow, little neck rest, little accoutrement to have around your house. Quality, just like everything Disney does. This is the giveaway. Again, like, subscribe, and comment your favorite Bob Gurr designed ride. I will be announcing the winner on Friday in a YouTube short and contacting the winner directly. And we will ship all this stuff to your home or wherever you want it shipped. Enter the contest and share this with your friends so they can enter also. All right, y'all.